and that we have talked about, to the bourgeois society and world of the 19th century, we must now come to a quite different. You could perhaps say that there are two kinds of reaction to this kind of work. One is the immediate spontaneous reaction, of which you have, let us say, an expressionist, in futurist, in Wedekind schoolboy that you have read about. Young people who immediately wanted to get out of the cage. And those reactions, by and large, though they lead to interesting cultural results, modern art, modern painting, modern literature, do not by and large have very long-range results, for reasons that Gustave Le Bon analyzed very well. They are not able to become a movement. To have a movement, certainly, as Le Bon also said, you have to have not a deeper root. That is to say, you have to have a longer period of historical gestation. The problem with expressionism, impressionism, futurism, the Wedekind, the Jean, is that all of these are written on periods of really very short, almost spontaneous action, and not on periods of longer gestation. Therefore, you might say that the two movements who in the end caught up all this revolt had longer gestations, and were in fact historical movements, one nationalism and one socialism. And it is therefore to these four long-range states that we must come, of course, to socialism now and to nationalism then, when we look at the First World War and see what it means. But socialism, of course, was not spontaneous, I don't have to tell you that, not an immediate reaction to stuff that you met, like Le Bon, you see being all head up by the Boulangerist revolt and the new crowds and so on. But rather, instead, a long historical gestation, and a historical gestation which had already raised severe problems. Now, the problems that we have to deal with are three in number. One problem is, of course, the fact that socialism, thanks to Engels, had already become a new policy. And that, in fact, socialist orthodoxy, which you will read with Trotsky, was a positive orthodoxy. That socialism had managed to make contact with Darwinism and science. And that, already from Engels and from Kautsky, this will go on. And that, in fact, Kautsky will not only be important for the official socialism of the post-war period, but that he will be resurrected in Bolshevism as well. The second problem is all the other parts of socialism, or let us put it, as somebody put it, all the other parts of socialism which tried to get out of the Bible, which didn't want to be like Kautsky, like official socialism, or Bolshevism, as you would say in Germany, a final railway state, where the train stopped forever, but who wanted instead to have a station through which trains could pass, a more open socialism. And the third problem is, of course, the relation of all this to what we might call, perhaps yes and no, a socialist culture, at least the attempt to make a socialist culture. Now, I want to be rather brief on the first two, the official orthodoxy, and the anti-solution, because we must keep to chronology. And the great Marxist revival against orthodoxy doesn't really come so much in our period as it comes after 1918, when Germany becomes the home for a new Hegelian revival in Marxism and other kinds of Kantian revival in Marxism. And we must come back to that part after 1918, with somewhat greater emphasis. But the problems are really given here already. So let us first look at what became, and what in fact has become, Marxist orthodoxy, the sort of thing that you will read in your Kautsky class struggle. For Kautsky became the Pope of socialism, not just in Germany or Austria, but all over the Western world. And as a Pope of socialism, he continued the work of Friedrich Engels, whose secretary, in fact, he has been Engels' secretary. And he continued it, and in a sense, he tried. If on over Marx's grave in 1884, Engels had already preached that Marx was the Darwin of the social science. His great faith was the Darwin of the social science. He already had put, therefore, socialism into contact with positivism and, in fact, transformed it into a new positivism. The laws of class struggle were no laws of science. Marxism prided itself to be a science. And as it prided itself to be a science, there was no room anymore, so it seemed, for human volition. The kind of thing that you always have in Marx, and that is always a problem in Marx, that if history works that way, why should you work to push history that way? Why not just go along for the free ride? If the victory of the proletariat is inevitable once capitalism reaches its height, why do you bother to fight? Why don't you go along for the free ride? And it was a question that Marx had answered very badly, because it's in fact a question very difficult to answer in Marxism. Marx said, oh well, because it's in human nature. It's in our human nature to fight rather than to be slaves, in question. But it was the only thing that Marx could say in order to make it clear why not go along for a free ride. It isn't inevitable anyway, yeah? So, Marx went to a theory of human nature. And with Marx, if you remember perhaps in 513 last year, human nature is very important. Marx says it is built on presuppositions about human nature. Without these presuppositions, it wouldn't work. It's built on the presupposition of rationality. It is built on the presupposition that you would rather fight than be a slave, of human rationality, and it is built on the presupposition of the idea of progress. And all three of them, the 18th century presupposition. We're again back, you know, in Marx with the Jewish bourgeoisie, which have kept these 18th century ideas, like Freud, when everybody has to look at objections, given them up. Marx there, in his assimilated Jewish family, in the city of Trier, in Germany, in the 1830s, lived an 18th century life. You read Rousseau, you wrote about the Enlightenment and all of that sort of thing, because that was what his father was all hepped up about, that was the road to assimilation, so obviously it lasted there. So obviously Marxism is built on a very questionable idea to the name. But once you assume this idea of human nature, Marx at least wasn't little. There was ample room for the human factor, because Marx was never a determinist, or sometimes yes, sometimes no, but mostly not a determinist for the thought, that he thought human nature or consciousness played no role at all, very little. That comes with Engels. For Engels, human nature is closed off. The presupposition has become, believe it or not, a scientific law. And the scientific laws are now based on these presuppositions, something that is totally clear in your Kautsky reading. In other words, I'd like to put it this way, that the presuppositions have been frozen into laws of evolution. Rationality is a scientific law which has nothing more to do with human nature, but it's the way the economy works. Become something purely materialistic. Progress is now a scientific law. In Kautsky it works whether you do anything about it or not. Really. So it's been quite rightly said Kautsky is really the founder of social democracy, because it is wage that it will come eventually, but it's also the founder of socialism, of course. So, what you have, therefore, is progress is not a scientific law. These are now, and the fact that men, and you will see that in Kautsky again, that men will fight rather than be slaves is a scientific law. Everything has become science in the age of positivism. This is partly because Engels was influenced by anthropology, and this is partly because Marxism had that trinity. Once you have a theory of history, and you say history works this way and no other, you're already on the treadmill of positivism, really. And you already have the problem of human cognition, or human belief, which is so very important here. Now, having said all this, there's another thing that comes into it. If all these things are true, if man is rational, if you'd rather fight than be a slave, if finally there is human progress, why sketch the world of the future? In other words, Marx has already done something very painful for Marxism. He has refused to say what the class of society was going to be like. All he said is that men, as you all know, to hunt in the morning and fish in the afternoon, which doesn't really speak for Marx, but instead of being a contributor to hunting in the direction of society, the horrible enemy, that freedom leads to brutality against animals, hunting in the morning and fish in the afternoon. A lot of hypocrisy and all of that. So, what you have there for years, that's all Marxism. And what he meant to say by the hunting and fishing is, not even leisure, because Marx had no concept of leisure. He was a purely historian. There's no idea of leisure. It is that you will do what you like to do, that the work will give you pleasure, that it won't be alienated work, but work integrated with your personality, work that is an alienated work that is meaningful to you. That's what he meant. He never had any, these people, all these socialists, had no theory of leisure. They were totally victorious people from that point of view. Come back to that when I talk about culture. Or I might say, now, that's the reason they oppose every initiative. It's actually very interesting that there's a dialectic here. The fossilization of Marxist theory in culture and the spontaneity of workers' culture. All the really popular things in workers' culture, if you want. Workers' sport. What's more popular than workers' sports? Red football, red cycling, yes, all that sort of stuff. Workers' sports, workers' choir society, yes? Workers' play-acting society. They all grew up against opposition from the socialist leaders. The socialist leaders, they thought workers would learn to be counseled. To be counseled, but they shouldn't do that. Their leader was distraction. Socialism has a great problem here. That leisure is distracted. Everything is didactic. And so it's built into these plays as well. Because if you have the idea that history is inevitable, if you have this theory of history determinism, then you have to know why. I mean, the one thing you can act on is to know what's inevitable. I mean, what's happening. That's what Kautsky wrote this. Once you've read this in Kautsky, it will determine your action. Because of your rationality, and thinking is all very rational, and because it's scientific, so you will accept it, and you will act on it, yes? But this means learning, didacticism. Oh, like this play, when the workers did have a play, which, for example, one of the early workers' plays is a play of forbidden love. And, you know, workers' plays adopt to what the football plays have, especially of the classical age, during the Schiller, Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, except Romeo is the union guy and Juliet is the boss's daughter. So if the union guy is the boss's daughter, but the boss's daughter converts. And about their love, they're about to kiss. And as they're about to go into the clinch, the boy says, wait a minute, do you know the theory of self-reliance. So, you have This didactic bears into them. Oh, you think that's so? Oh, yes, I'm talking to the mind of socialist generation, yes. So not from the other way, not socialist or mindless, but it was always so. I remember that when I was in the socialist league and Dayton in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was in graduate school and so on, first, the girl was, had to have a catechism, of course. I mean, we didn't go on the bank of the child like you and talk about sex. We did talk about surface value of the past, and all of that sort of thing. And if the girl responded rightly, then we could go to the next. However it might be, there is a deductivism here. Yes? A deductivism here, because it's not as important for the future as the past struggle. You don't date the person's story. So, what you have here then, is this always dialectic, this fear, this idea that socialism is educated? No. Nothing is more educational. The beginning of adult education is the beginning of all of this. Because you have to know that your Kautsky book is a breviary for the work, is a breviary that you have to know. It's what you have to know, he put together here, as you will see. Now, if you look at Kautsky with this in mind, I think it's quite clear what it's all about. First of all, utopia is out. Utopia is out. Never in the history of mankind has it happened that a revolutionary party was able to proceed and determine the new social order. That's, of course, not true. All the utopian socialists were perfectly well what the new order was like Fourier. Who founded these Fourier colonies in Wisconsin and elsewhere. But for Marxism, he said, it's necessary. It isn't necessary. Because the new order will logically grow out of the old, just as the proletariat grows out of the class struggle, and one thing grows out of another. Bourgeois grows out of feudalism, proletariat grows out of bourgeois, and in the end, the concentration of capitalism inevitably means the victory of the proletariat, and then you go fishing in the morning and hunting in the afternoon. I mean, you don't. Now, this, of course, is a great advantage. Don't you see? If you are a political movement, you can't make out a utopia. You're much better off in a political movement if you leave it vague, yes? You know. Obviously. So it's not only a disadvantage, it's only a disadvantage for intellectuals, it's also an advantage. And as a matter of fact, that was least criticized. That wasn't very much criticized by those who wanted to change Marxism in an other direction. The end of a definite utopia was not criticized. But what was criticized was that it led really to the end of all utopia. Because what you have here is instead utopia ideas of inevitability, ideas of inevitable progress, yes? Inevitable progress. And once you have this inevitable progress, then, of course, there is really no utopia. This is page 123 of your reading. Never yet in the history of mankind has it happened, quite especially, that a revolutionary party was able. And then go to page 158, where he says, where he goes through history, that in the end, men will be elevated, and that elevating will do it. Happy the man to whom it is given to contribute to the realization of this idea. By which you mean, happy is the man who has learned the way science works, and who has, as it were, adjusted to the natural laws of science, which are, in this case, the natural laws of social science. The problem here, I think, is a problem which is clear, should be clear, the problem of utopia. The problem which people began to see above or after the war, whether indeed people see necessity and act upon necessity in quite such illogical fashion. Because the Kautsky believes that when people acted on necessity, there was no need really for violence and bloodshed. On page 91 of your reading, he makes it quite clear that as these are natural laws, if people would only act according to these natural laws. Now, there would be no need for violence and bloodshed. The ruling classes, he said, could be clear-sighted. You know, and see what ways to go. Jump on the bandwagon, yes? And of course, the revolution is not decided at one blow, because it's the history evolution, the historical evolution. One thing after another evolved. But the problem of utopia remains. It's not the only problem here, but it's a problem I want to address myself briefly, because it shows you what it involves. In 1918, a man called Ernst Bloch wrote a very famous book on a revolutionary of the Reformation, Thomas Münzer, who was a radical reformer, a radical Protestant reformer of the 16th century. But he wrote this book because he believed that what was needed is utopia, that you could not have a revolution without a utopia, that you could not have a revolution without apocalypse, without holding a utopia and apocalypse in front of the people. That if you wanted to have a revolution, if you can't just say science or natural law will bring you there, but you also have to have a utopia. And he wrote about Thomas Münzer because Thomas Münzer was an apocalyptical. He believed in the apocalypse, in the second coming, in the kind of thing. So that, what Locke tried to do, is very much like the bowl in one thing, that you cannot have revolution without myth. So where is it? And the myth that you need for revolution is utopia. Now that is the one great criticism of Kautsky, when you read Kautsky, that there is no longer, you may agree or disagree, but people thought at the time that in this kind of official socialism, there was no utopia. And therefore, there was no excitement, no enthusiasm, just science and education. How could you make a revolution? That's one thing. Let's get.
Why is the science, the positivism, negate the utopia? Why is the utopia going to capitalism too?
No, because if you have evolution, remember this is a Darwin, if you have evolution, then you know it, and yeah, if you combine it, as these people did, with the 18th century of progress, then you know that there will be a good society. But a good society must not be hurried. It comes in the process of evolution, of scientific law. There is no idea of an apocalypse. There is no idea of an immediate change. There is no idea really of a utopia, immediate utopia before the people. If there is a utopia, it will grow slowly out of the evolution. Yeah? You see, Marx started that already. Marx changed his mind. He did on everything. Otherwise, he would not have lasted. Because you have to pass on to this and this according to the occasion. But by and large, what Marx said on the whole was that there can be no revolution until capitalism is developed to its fullest extent. And that's what counts. You've got to work. You've got to be good. Yeah? That's what. At times, Marx said, ah, the time is here, the Paris Communist Revolution of 1848. And then when this didn't work out, he said, well, I was mistaken, the time isn't here. Capitalism has not yet developed its full extent, etc. Yeah? You see what I mean? So, what I mean by utopia is not that it isn't a utopia. Fishing and hunting, this metaphor is a utopian metaphor. But there is no immediate utopia. You have to spend it for you. Yeah? There is no immediate. The appeal is to patience. And because the appeal is to patience, the appeal is to education. Because you say to the worker, you must be educated. First, you must be educated. You must know the natural laws and end up. It's just the opposite from spontaneity. And you can say this, Mr. Damien, perhaps that's the better way of putting it. That Ernst Bloch's criticism of the absence of an immediate utopia. Thomas Münzer had an immediate utopia. His followers thought Christ would come tomorrow. And the other criticism, which there are three criticisms, I might as well do that. One is law. The second great criticism on law is the criticism of what we call the country. Now, I want to say more about that, obviously. That is those people who say, how horrible, what a pity is that Marx lives in the age of Hegel and not in the age of Kant. What does that mean? That Marx ignored eternal ethical standards. And these people to whom I will come believe that you must infuse the class struggle with standards. That means you have a relation to the end, that you must always act morally, that you must not use any immoral means or means of force, because that will take the end, that it is bad that Marx would not come. And then again makes it open-ended, because it gives it the utopia of Kant, the utopia of ethical man, if you like, to contract that. That's one. And the third criticism, these are all ways of opening conflict, yeah? Yeah? And the third criticism, equally famous, is connected, I suppose, most of the day with George Lukács. Not all of them. Only the young George Lukács I talk about. 1922 George Lukács, when he wrote the most famous book, I suppose, in revisionist Marxism, called History of Class Consciousness, of 1922. And when Lukács in History of Class Consciousness, to which I will come back, in 1922, raised the great problem. And the great problem Lukács raised is, what about human consciousness? In other words, isn't cognition important? Can we just say, as Kautsky said, that the economic laws will determine your consciousness? That if you, Kautsky says, and you will find it very dull in this way, Kautsky says, what's important is the economic law. And the economic laws will determine your action. Once you know the economic laws, you will act that way. Because there's an assumption, the assumption of rationality. That all socialists have. The assumption of rationality. You will act that way, yeah? But Lukács says instead, no, not at all. First we have to raise consciousness. Consciousness must become before action. And that comes, of course, then again to what Marcuse will say, the exaggerated theory must come before action. But what they mean is consciousness must come before action. Now, all these three ways are the three main ways of breaking up Marxism. And most of the revisionists of that regard, revisionists of the left, have one of these three stress. Either the stress on cognition, or the stress on Kant, or the stress on some kind of utopia. Either have these three stress. Now, there is a revisionism, however, on the right as well. And that revisionism on the right, and I'm acquainted with the history of socialism, is the revisionism of Edward Bernstein, which really says, which is really social democracy, that is to say, that is called revisionism. These are just the revisions. But the revisionism on the right of Kautsky is called revisionism. That would do away with all of it. That draws the logical conclusion from Kant, really, and says we don't need revolution, all we need is parliamentary government, all we need is trade union, let us better the workers' lot now. Eventually, everything needs top socialism. Let us support corporations, let us support monopoly capitalism, because it will be easier for socialists to take over. There's a great 2 point there, by the way. Support monopoly capitalism because it's easier for socialism to take over, let's say, Exxon or Standard Oil than it is a lot of small business, which is already ready-made for paper. So this is revisionism, parliamentary government, and all of this. And in the last resort, Kautsky was on that side. Kautsky rejected Lenin, rejected Bolshevism, and became a social democrat in his old age. A social democrat, however, who was always reluctant with revisionism, and even if the Bolsheviks did not count because he opposed that they used it, that's from Russia. So, of course, he was still the Pope of Marxist Orthodoxy. I don't care what Marxist Orthodoxy. He is the Pope of the DDL, for example, today. It's based on it. Now, one more word that I don't want to get. When you read Kautsky, you read him for this, but also you can read him for to refresh your Marxism, because the whole first part of this book is really good, Marxism through the eyes of Engels, not through Marxism, through Engels' eyes, Marxism as it became, which is, after all, what is important. Now, with all of this, let me say something. Kautsky's ideas of orthodoxy did not stand alone. Orthodox Marxism was not really based on Kautsky, but Orthodox Marxism, or socialism, let's use that word, also took over the tradition of the revolutions of 1848, especially in Germany. And indeed, German social democracy, which became the chief social democracy in Europe, which is the social democracy to which everybody looked in other countries, was a mixture, typically enough, between the heritage of the revolution of 1848 and the orthodoxy of Kautsky. And what that meant practically for socialists, it enabled socialists to enter into parliament. It weakened, if you like, the revolutionary drive. The real fault of practical socialism is not Kautsky or Engels or Marx, but the real founder of practical socialism is somebody else, namely Ferdinand Lassalle. Ferdinand Lassalle, who founded the first working man's movement in Europe, really, the first working man's movement in Europe in 1864, called the Universal Working Men's Association. Ferdinand Lassalle was a friend of Marx and Engels, but he was above all a revolutionary of 1848. And he carried into this first the workers' movement the tradition of political remedies for social ills. He believed that the state should do it. He believed in nationalization. His economic beliefs were very similar to Kautsky, or rather, I would say, to Engels and Marx. But these beliefs, similar to Engels and Marx, he believed that the state should enforce. And indeed, he was a friend of Bismarck's state for the reason that he believed that Bismarck's state was strong enough to enforce this kind of socialism. Indeed, Lassalle was a funny mixture. He was also a romantic. He died the most unsocialist death imaginable. He died in a duel about a woman, about his mistress. So, he died in a duel. He was a romantic. But Lassalle is important for us really for two reasons. First of all, that German social democracy is a fuse of what we call a solid Marx. Fuse in 1875. Is that the progress was a fusion of the two. That indeed the working class strives for emancipation within the framework of the present state. It strives for emancipation with the framework of the present state. So that in the end, social democracy indeed became dominated by Kautsky. While it had the Kautskyan vocabulary, it was always a parliamentary party. It always looked to the state, and that was its heritage from the start. But it had another heritage from the start that was mentioned now. And that heritage is the cultural, to which we shall come back. Lassalle was the only socialist leader, typically enough, who believed in a way in mass action. and Bob Litter, the German General Workers' Party, got not only a hymn, a song, a very famous workers' song, On to the Sun, very famous, still the social democratic song in Germany today, On to the Sun, brother. It got a song, it got a flag, when that house visited his group, it was called the Army Inspection. Army inspections, and they turned out with flour and garland. There was a kind of leadership cut about the stuff. A leadership cut, very much, with flowers and garlands and cloth. And I'll come back to that, of course. But here we have already that with the state, the Zionism had not so much the emphasis on education, but indeed a kind of apocalyptic emphasis in this first movement, which was changed down by the Kautsky influence. So you have always in socialism, whether it's Germany or otherwise, a fair dose of 1848, and therefore a fair dose of the idea that the state and the parliament that can in fact do it. But you don't only have that. You have therefore, on the one hand, to summarize it, on the one hand, you have socialist orthodoxy, which is Kautsky plus Lassalle. What it means is really what you read in Kautsky, the Engels scientific positivistic socialism, together with an emphasis on the state. You enter parliament, and in the end, you really work for democracy. You say, what's the utopia? The utopia is universal suffrage, like 1848. In the end, the utopia is universal suffrage, that is to say, political cure for economic ill. Yes? All right, that is orthodox on the intellectual level. But from orthodoxy, we must look on the intellectual level, really, to these three other alternatives to break it open. Now, before I look at it, one word. I'm not dwelling long on orthodoxy because I think this is fair to study for it. If a German worker could read it of the 1900s, you can understand. So, it's self-explanatory. Before one word. Again, a cultural problem. These attempts to break up Marxism, to dehumanize, to give it a human face. These were all attempts to give it a human face, to bring in the personal factor. These were all attempts by intellectuals, which had very little effect on the actual history of workers' movement. So the history of workers' movement is a Kautsky-Lassalle history of workers' movement. It's not a history of workers' movement influenced by Ernst Bloch, the Kantians, though they made a revolution in Bavaria or Luca. These are matters of intellect. And so we must say this, that when we talk now about these attempts to break up Marxism by these intellectuals, we are really dealing in cultural history, but the cultural history of the intellectual. This is a problem to which we have not been addressed now. Because up to this point, all that we've done, really, is the cultural history of intellectuals. Because apart from Le Bon, there hasn't been much mass movement culture. But as we come to socialism, there is mass culture. And we must therefore distinguish, and in socialism and in everything else, mass culture. That is, what people really read. When we come to the Weimar Republic, the kind of things you love about the Weimar Republic, yes? The films and so on. That's what my friend George Lichtheim used to call an inner Jewish dialogue. Anything to do with Germany. What people really read and so on, that's something quite different, yes? They read the same popular literature from the end of the 1880s on. That's something quite different. And in socialism, it is a very big problem. Because, of course, these intellectuals wanted to reach out to the masses. They wanted to reach out to the masses. What is involved, however, I want to illustrate to you concretely with this speech, which the main German socialist leader gave in 1892, August Bebel, a member of parliament, a working class chair, yes? A friend of Kautsky, Scott. In Bebel in 1892 in parliament gave a remarkable speech in the German Diet, by which he said several things. He said, we don't know what to do with intellectuals, because intellectuals do not believe in science. And therefore, what we'd better have is a probationary period in the party for intellectuals. That idea never died in socialism, despite it in the third. The socialists disturb. Secondly, he said, moreover, these socialists are pushy. He meant they're mostly Jews, especially the ones that come to the country he was like. They're pushy. And thirdly, he said, they water down Marxism into an ethical imperative. And what he meant by that is they give up science, and they are apt to give up the class struggle, because they believe in ethical standards and in the primacy of ethical standards. And indeed, all of these, and I don't care what you put it, the Kantians like Eisner, Toller in Germany and others, Ernst Bloch, who just died a year ago, Ernst Bloch and the Kantians and Lukács, all of those believed in some way that they were the conscience of the working class. All of them wanted to reach out. And how do you do it? Well, Ernst Lukács did it the worst possible way. After 1922, he joined Stalinist orthodoxy and wrote garbage for almost the rest of his life. That is, he changed with his party life. For Lukács, after his first book, to stay in contact, he's probably right, to stay in contact with the working class, with intellectuals, was to follow the Stalinist line, or as he would have put it, to stay in the Communist Party and follow the Communist Party line. For the others, it was much different. The Kantians would come to Bloch, of course, went back eventually to Communist East Germany and fled. Lukács himself was a minister under the Nazi government of 56 in the Hungarian Revolution against Bolshevism. He was always sort of very never quite comfortable. And at the moment, I must tell you, all Lukács' students have had to flee Hungary into Australia and America. Because, obviously, the orthodoxy is still the orthodoxy. It's still a Kautskyesque orthodoxy. And the Lukács students, the Bloch students, and, of course, the Kantians are not welcome in communist Europe, no more welcome from them than they were for our state. For example, these are the troubles of intellectuals. You don't put them in prison anymore, you give them visas, which is very nice, because I spent a lovely 2 months in company of the two chief Lukács students, and I learned a lot. But you mustn't be under any illusion that what I'm going to talk about now would ever really succeed in making contact with the working class. Would ever really succeed. It is a part of the history of intellectuals. And you can see that yourself, of course, because what I'm talking about is very much alive. That all of those who tried to put it into practice in the 1960s in the United States and Germany eventually saw the only thing that they could be is professors, which is hardly what they started out to be. Yeah? Now, let us look one after another at these three ways to which we should come back to a breakover. To make it, how do you call it in English, a station where the train stops? Yeah? Well, you don't know trains anymore.
Terminal.
What? A terminal. Yeah, a terminal. To make Marxism not a terminal, but a, what we call a station where the train goes through. That's really what is involved here. And it is very typical that Bernstein did make contact with the working class. That Bernstein, a friend of trade unionists, The first is an acquisition of property. The division to the right has no problem. It's the division to the left that has the problem of making a contact with the worker. Lastly, let me look at one or the other. And look, can you let me look first for a minute in chronological order at the Kantians. Kantians, who are the closest perhaps to us and who are the easiest to understand, but I must say they all overlap. All these things to break Marxism overlap. Why? Because they all thought they were Marxists. Let me make this clear. All of the people I'm going to talk about, these intellectuals who tried to make it a true way, all of them believed in the class struggle. All of them believed in the triumph of the proletariat. All of them believed that history worked the way Marx and Engels and Kautsky said. What if? That into history they wanted to reintroduce eternal capital. You can say that then that Marx, Engels and Kautsky relativizes history. That's the best solution. They relativize. But you've got to absolutize it again. Yeah? Either to make a revolution, as we shall see when we come to Eisner. By the way, children, there are only two intellectuals who ever made revolutions in the intellectual. One I can talk about on Friday, called Eisner, who made a revolution in Bavaria. He didn't know what he was doing. He simply addressed a mob and began to storm it. And the other is, of course, a right-wing intellectual, Gabriel D'Annunzio, who ruled the city for four years. And it's much easier for right-wing intellectuals, because the right-wing has a place for intellectuals, because they make a political literacy, yes? They're not the conscience, they make the political literacy. But these intellectuals, the left-wing ones, who came from the cafe, is living. To show you what is involved in this Marxist country, I want to start with Eisner's famous essay, Marx and Kant in 1934. For the man who was to make the revolution, or lead a revolution in 1934, wrote an essay as well. And with this we'll deal on Friday. And that means that...